It's music that has been said to be unplayable and unlistenable, and now it's getting a world premiere in Brookings. Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Pianist, composer, and filmmaker Telef Johnson brings a piano sonata to Brookings this Thursday, but it is not just any piano sonata. Johnson will perform an epic work by the English composer Sarabji. It consists of 10 movements broken into 3 parts, and each part takes about 2.5 hours to perform. So if you're doing the math with me, that means the concert, with 2 30-minute intermissions, will stretch more than 7.5 hours. For decades, Sarabji refused to let anyone perform his work. Telef Johnson says the music sat in libraries until the world caught up with the composer.
The composer's name is Sarabji. That's his last name. His full name is Kaikhosru Shapurji Sarabji. Shapurji means son of the king. So it's a very formal Indian name that he took from his father. He had been born in London. His mother was British, and this is a long time ago, in 1892. So he lived all the way from 1892 to 1988. But he left this vast legacy of all these unrealized works that were very vast, very long, very intricate, and they summed up a lifetime of his preoccupation with music of the 20th century avant-garde, you know, the wartime music of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but infused with his cultural roots, which are anchored in the Zoroastrian classical tradition, which is of great floridity and complexity and borrowing from the Indian idiom entirely. You know, the vast architectural structures, the textiles, the details, and he brought all of these influences into something as straightforward as a piano piece.
When do you get introduced to his music to the point where you think, this is different? Do you hear it performed ever? Like, where does that spark come from?
Right, and I think you tapped on something interesting. You said, did you hear it performed? The only way anybody has known about this composer for the last 100 years is on paper, because his music was published, and it was distributed by Oxford Press, and so it's in libraries all over the world. But that's really the only way you can discover it, is in a library or in a bookstore. But it's all visual, because there's not enough performances for you to casually stumble along one. And usually you won't seek out a recording unless you see the music, because how would you know the recording exists? You're not going to just find an LP or a CD randomly as much, even though the young generation finds Sarabji on YouTube, and so he's quite popular on YouTube.
Yeah.
But when I found the music, it was printed music, because I didn't have the internet. There was no way to discover this composer except in a library where his music was there.
So you look in the library, you see this, do you hear it in your head at that? What was interesting
no
to
way.
You the about his work?
The music was too dense and complicated on the page. And I think it struck the graphic designer in me, because I loved how it looked.
The architect.
Yes, the architect, the graphic designer.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of useless skills, and or skills rather that I have not been able to realize, perhaps is a better way of phrasing it. And I just loved the way his music looked, and it went on and on for 65 pages. This was a piano sonata, and I just said, it's too long to be a joke. But if it was just a page or two, I would almost wonder if someone was trying to put a joke on me, to think that this could be a real piece. Because, you know, pianists play all sorts of florid music, but this was taking it to another level. There were multiple staffs and music just all over the place, but it didn't look like it could be ugly. It looked like it could be beautiful. So I tried some of it on the piano, and I said, this reminds me of impressionistic music, which was my favorite music at the time. That's the French composers, Debussy and Ravel. And this seemed to be kind of a hyper offshoot of that, maybe what would be the next step after the French impressionists. And that's what inspired me to it.
He didn't want his music to be played. He didn't allow his music to be played. What do you know about his relationship to the performance of things that he had written, his compositions?
You know, composers can sometimes be about control, because if you think about it, they're just with a pen and paper. And so that can be lonely, because they don't have any performers around them, because they haven't written anything to perform. So before they do hear their music, there's that period of time where it's just them and their thoughts transmitted to paper. And he just spent too much time in that part of the step. He got so completely consumed by that process, and it's easy to want to assert control over every note, every dynamic, because that's what you're taught to do. You can control a performance through what you put down on the paper, and it became such a mania and obsession for him that when people couldn't quite reproduce it the way it looked or the way it seemed it could be, he said, well, what's the point? I'd rather just have these as large architectural blueprints. It's almost like designing the most amazing castle you could ever imagine, and just there's not the budget to build it, so that's okay. We'll just look at this beautiful castle of what could be and put it away, and that's all right.
Da Vinci comes to mind. I can design this, but it cannot be made. And years later, someone says, we can make that now, and it was genius.
And maybe that someone had to wait, I don't know how many hundreds of years, but to a time where there would be the proper technology to do so.
Yeah. Tell us the piece that you're performing and help us understand the last 15 years of is obsession the right word, or your dedication?
Well, keep in mind, I did many, many things. And so for a while, it was a hobby. You know, you just have this piece sitting around, and all of a sudden, we did get it into the computer where the manuscript was inputted into a music software program where the scrawl on the page became very clear notes that were inputted by a tireless mathematician and musician, Alex, who's now passed on. And so it was much easier to read after it was engraved by computers. So that eased the process. But in the meantime, I did other things. I had other pursuits, but I would kind of return to this piece and just say, boy, that could be really something if I could ever get it together someday. And there was immediate interest on the internet. But again, it was a fantasy and not a reality. And so once the fantasy became a reality or showed a potential of being a reality, then I started to kind of hone in on it more and zero in on it more. And when the pandemic happened and we all had so much time to sit around, I said, this is the moment where I can make an unrealistic fantasy that was also an unrealistic fantasy of the composer. So it's a double unrealistic fantasy for both performer and composer. And I think I can make this real. I think I can make this happen because I have the time and I happen to have the resources, and this must be the time to do it, now or never.
What's the piece called?
It's called Sonata 5, which is easy to remember, Fifth Sonata, but the subtitle almost really takes over the title. Opus Archi Magicum, which is Latin title. It means work of the grand sorcerer.
Nice.
So it's a mystical fantasy piece, and I kind of call it a Lord of the Rings trilogy of the piano, because it's in three parts. Each part is proportionate, 2.5 hours. Each part talks about the tarot cards, and the third part references the actual card, the magician.
At what point does it occur to you to perform the whole thing at once?
Well, so it was bit by bit. I learned it during the pandemic, and then immediately there was the opportunity to record it. So I jumped into the recording session, having it in my fingers. But time went by, and I finished the recording, and then suddenly I was like, I know this piece so well, because not only did I learn it to record it, now it's in my brain because I listened to it so many times having finished the recording. And you can just point to any part of the 430-page score, and I can tell you where it is in the piece. You know, you just take one little thing out, and I'll recognize what movement it is and where it is, and it's just because I'm so familiar with it. So I said, you know, if I don't perform it now, I'll forget it. And, you know, when you forget the music in your head, then you have to relearn it, and it takes a long time. So I said, this is the time. If not now, never.
The pandemic was 5 years ago.
It began the project in 2020, so I learned it in 2020. And 2021, a little bit of recording, and then finished at the end of 2021. And now it's 2022, and the pandemic is still going. So I said, what will end first, my recording or the pandemic? And my recording actually ended before the pandemic was kind of officially wound down. And then I took some time to put the best parts together into a 7.5-hour recording, because I recorded a lot of music. I've recorded the piece many times. So it's been this very multi-year process of all these stages and all these layers to get it done.
What did you learn about the composer as you played all those components and really embodied the piece itself?
I learned a lot, because I realized he was a lot more assured than I realized, because a lot of his music has a novelty value because it's so odd and he banned his pieces, and so immediately he's a conversation piece. But with this particular work, I got to the fifth movement, which is alone 80 minutes long. And even though a lot of these long movements, because it's 10 movements, housed in three parts, and a lot of the longer movements have a kind of freewheeling, extemporaneous vibe, the fifth movement was so well thought of, both harmonically and rhythmically and structurally, even though it has this kind of improv feel, there was just so much talent just reeking out of this. And when I say talent, that's something we can't quantify. I could never do that. I could never sit down. I'm a composer, but I could never sit down and write that fifth movement the way he did or even think of something like that. It just would never occur to me, no matter how much I've studied or how good I think I am. I could never do something like that. And so that means that's talent, and that's a unique talent he brought to this piece. And he was not always consistent in that way. You kind of have to dig through his 11,000 pages of music and find the gems in this massive archive of material.
Yeah. Why Brookings? Why bring it to Brookings for a performance?
Two reasons. I recorded the piece in Brookings in the big hall, the Larson Concert Hall. And if it weren't for David Reynolds, who at the time oversaw the hall as part of his duties as department head, I would not have recorded the piece there because he was so positive about the project, and he just made it easy. He didn't throw up a bunch of gauntlets or have such indifference that it just would wither on the vine. So I was very grateful to him because I had full control over a 1,000-seat hall for a very long time, and I was the engineer, I was the producer, I was also the pianist. So I, like Sarabji, wielded enormous control over the project. I decided where the mics were. I decided how many mics there would be. I decided everything. And with that came a lot of responsibility, though. It wasn't exactly fun to have so much control. But we got it done there. And so I thought, well, why not play the piece there again? Because, again, you have so much freedom in a place that's open to your adventure.
What can people expect from the performance? I want to talk about how you're going to prepare to just really endure and, you know, avoid injury, for example, and stay hydrated and all those things with this sort of ultra marathon musically that you're doing. But first, let's talk about the audience. If the audience comes to see this, what is my experience like?
And I think that the challenge of a piece like this is it has a global audience. And a lot of the people who would sit there for every minute of the 7.5 hours, plus the two intermissions, which are half hour a piece, they would sit there for the whole time and really focus in on every detail. But again, that's people in Asia. That's people in Great Britain. That's people maybe here in Texas or New York, but they're not in Brookings. And so what I'm bringing to Brookings is the spectacle, the concept of something new, something that they can discover. And in fact, they can be the first to hear it, you know, and I like that. I like seeing Brookings as a satellite location. Or maybe a key component to this bigger, large-scale project, which seems to stretch many medias and many layers.
Yeah. Will you record the live performance then?
I will, and I'm going to release part of it or sections of it that I like on Instagram and YouTube, so that way people can get a sense of what it's like to maybe capture a couple of minutes, but it's in the middle of the piece where I've been playing already for 4 hours. Yeah. So it heightens the intensity. And if you play a C major chord, after 4 hours, that C major chord has a added weight that just playing a C major chord randomly on a piano would not have. Or the final chord, which is in B minor. That B minor chord is going to be a big deal because it's been building up to that B minor chord for 7.5 hours. So for those people who sit the whole time, they will sense that epic sense of scale that comes with time going by. And other people might just come by for a little bit because I can't tell people what to do. I want to expose this piece to them, but it might be more of a installation, you know, where it's like you come in and you walk through the museum and you leave, and that's me playing the piano, you know, for this long period of time. And that's a fine way to do it, too. Or you can just come and close your eyes and meditate and daydream, like I do sometimes, and just kind of let the music take you to somewhere else. You know, you don't have to sit there with the score following it unless you want to.
How are you going to prepare yourself physically, mentally, and maybe even spiritually, if we circle back to some of the themes of the piece? But physically, how do you prepare yourself for this?
I think the trick is to, in general, have a good lifestyle where you know, you do stretching exercises and you walk and you're in decent shape. One time I had some neck problems, shoulder problems, just from slouching or taking long walks where my head's down. And I've been told that's like having a bowling ball on your neck. You know, if you have your head facing down for too long, and it will, you know, maybe do a little bit of stress on you. So when I started taking yoga, things got stretched out, and all of a sudden I could move my legs up on the piano. I had a piece where I had to bang the piano with my foot. And the first time I tried to do that, I pulled a muscle, but after doing yoga, suddenly my legs were flexible enough I could, you know, play with two hands and then having the foot, so three limbs on the keys. So the yoga is a key. It stretches you out. It keeps you limber. And, you know, having a masseuse, I have a massage therapist friend, Julie, and she is really good at targeting those muscles that are sore, not so much from playing the piano, but just from living and walking around. And so I've never really had any problems with playing the piano as a grown-up in terms of fatigue or hurting my hands or getting tired. It's just wear and tear as a human. And so you always have to make sure your posture is good and you want to stand up tall. And when you sit at the piano, you keep your shoulders down, don't tense up, and don't do histrionic gestures, even though that's very popular to do. You know, every time you do a big gesture with your arm or this or that, if you're doing that for 7.5 hours, you will dislocate something sooner than later, or you will have terrible back problems later.
So every motion has a purpose.
You have to be economical.
Okay.
And I know this doesn't sound very sexy, but you have to be kind of like a typist. You know how you see people who type 100 words a minute, and maybe they're working in an office. And they're just, you know, their hands are on the keys. There's very little movement, and every key is struck to get the words written. But it looks boring. There's not much effort there, and you have to bring that into your performance. So you hope that the music that comes out of the piano is exciting, and all the colors you bring and the dynamic range is grabbing people. But you yourself are actually an enigma, just a specter, you know, sitting there.
Emotionally, mentally, spiritually, what is that like for you as the performer at this point?
Well, I really like it because for me, you know, you wouldn't perform these long pieces if you didn't like to perform for people.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, there's so much time where you're by yourself to learn it. So then all of a sudden you go from the kind of introspective lifestyle to suddenly a performative lifestyle, and people are there. And so that charges the air with energy, and it is much more inspiring, I think. And so all those things that you mentioned, emotionally, spiritually, physically, they're all triggered with much more energy from the kinetic experience of performing live. And obviously in a controlled way where you don't overdo anything, but inside you're very stimulated and you're excited, and that keeps your energy going because it's a narrative that is being glimpsed and watched and recorded. And I think that kind of gives you the energy as opposed to just being by yourself and playing it alone to yourself.
Why do this? Is it because, you know, like you're climbing the mountain because it's there, or because it is going to contribute something to the world of music? Like, help me understand the importance possibly of knowing in India, in England, in, you know, wherever, that this guy showed up in Brookings, South Dakota, and he did this performance, and the music was in the world for 7.5 hours, and people were there. What does it mean?
Well, I think what's important is that it happened somewhere in the world, and it was a place that I felt comfortable in which to do this, in which to launch this world, this work, and this recording to the world, and in an intimate spot with friends and family. With supportive people, and all of a sudden you kind of want to be in that hall all day long, and you enjoy it because of the history that you've had with it growing up. And so I think that's what means a lot to me, is being able to premiere this work with friends and family at the ready in a place that's very far from the coasts. I've premiered various movements, shorter movements, in California on the West Coast. So I know what, and I've performed in New York City, Merkin Hall, and, you know, some of Sarabji's music. So I know what it's like to play on the coasts. But I enjoy the intimate, personal aspect, too, of performing, and where you can play with your friends, for your friends, and people who've known you your adult life. And so there's kind of a personal angle to that, too, that I enjoy. But as far as the length goes, I never thought I would play such a long piece. It's just that, you know, push comes to shove. You say, well, I've kind of known about this. I think this is an interesting challenge, and I think it's a great piece of music, and I think it has a historical component that I'm proud to serve. And yet it's a crazy adventure, and I'm always up for a crazy adventure because that's what stimulates my mind.
Are there parts of the piece that are your favorites that you are particularly drawn to for what reason?
Well, it's interesting because I don't have any Asian bloodline as far as I know. My background is British and Norwegian, but maybe there's enough of a Brit in me, and there was enough of a Brit in him where we found some common ground. There has to be. I'm sure that's what it is, because I'm 50% British, so he was a British composer. There is a connection there. But I love when he embraces the Arabic, Byzantine, Persian side of him. I always love that, because it seems so alien for a piano piece. And so it stimulates my mind, because it's something that only he did. And I love the long music, because I've played Hindustani music before with Hindustani musicians who let me into their circle. And so I know what it's like to just hold a note for an hour, and you just lose yourself in your thoughts, in your mind, or maybe you don't have any thoughts. You're just gone. And you wake up and you realize you were there in front of people, you know, involved in this kind of hypnotic music making, which he brings into the piece. So in movement two, I play the note B for 21 minutes over and over again. And there's all sorts of things happening above it and below it, but the B is the center. And if you look at Hindustani music, they always have their center as represented in the tambura instrument. It's a drone. There's not a single piece that doesn't have a drone that anchors and plays for however long their music is. So Sarabji's bringing that drone into his music, and that's something that you even see in today's popular electronic music, you know, kind of trance music. And so I like the trance aspects of his music the best.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, something I didn't ask you about this experience or about the composer himself, that you think is really important right now to tell people?
I think this is a really unique composer who did not get his chance in life, but he did some smart moves. He published his music, so it was discovered. And then he allowed his friends to take his music and microfilm it back in the 70s and 80s. And to this day, there's still efforts by his friends to keep his music alive. And then when a new recording comes out, then it becomes the norm. It becomes the standard. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, yeah, Sarabji, you know. But before, he was just an enigma, just a concept. And so I think that's really exciting that we can take something that was locked away in his cupboard, and now it's put in a computer. Now it's recorded, and now it's on everyone's cell phones.
And you're part of that.
Yes.
Telef Johnson's performance of Sarabji's Piano Sonata 5 is this Thursday in the Founders Recital Hall at the Oscar Larson Performing Arts Center on the campus of South Dakota State University in Brookings. That's December 18th. Now, Johnson will offer a public pre-concert warm-up at 9:30 a.m. You'll hear some familiar pieces then. And then the actual performance begins at 10 a.m. It goes until 6:30. There'll be two 30-minute intermissions. Attendees are invited to stay for a few moments or a few hours. And the whole performance is free. That's our conversation for today. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.